Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Who's that lady?
Who's that lady?
Beautiful lady.
Who's that lady?
Who's that lady?
Who's that lady?
That real, real, real fine lady.
The beautiful lady.
I wish somebody would introduce her to me.
The Statue of Liberty has become one of the most recognizable monuments in the world, a symbol of freedom and the American dream. In her new book, Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty, journalist Elizabeth Mitchell tells the story of the envisioning, funding, and building of the Statue of Liberty, dispelling long-standing myths around its creation. It's a great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Mitchell to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is, I find it fascinating that one of your ideas in writing this book was to bust some of the myths around the Statue of Liberty, how it arrived here and why and how it was built. When did you start to become aware of these myths?
I didn't really set out to bust myths necessarily, but what had happened was I was at the New York Public Library Manuscript Division, and I was doing research for something else, and I noticed that they held the diary and the letters from when Frederick Auguste Bartholdi first came to America to pitch the project. And in reading those, I realized that, you know, he had had the idea before he came here. He was coming here pitching it cold. He didn't think, you know, there was no certainty that people were going to go for it, and he wasn't coming under the auspices of the French government, that was for certain. So I realized this is the story of one man coming up with this fantastic idea to create this colossus in the harbor, and it was really his efforts by hook and by crook to get it done. And to me, then I wanted to tell the story because, to me, that's a far more interesting story than the kind of, like, you know, a gift from France to America. and it makes more sense. I mean, you need somebody with drive to get the thing done, and so this story indeed had that.
A man with drive, but also a man that you describe, in no particular order, obnoxious, driven,
he was
peevish, mm-hmm. and ultimately crazy.
Well, he was, He was crazy because no one had created anything like this in recent times. Perhaps
right.
back in Rhodes, you know, in ancient Rhodes, they had created something of the same size. But he was definitely coming up with a wild idea, and partly what's crazy about it, too, is that when he left France to come pitch it over here, he wasn't just leaving France as we know it now. It was war-torn. They had just finished the Franco-Prussian War. In fact, when he went back to Paris to visit his studio before coming over to the United States, his place was riddled with bullet holes. There were, you know, they were burying 10,000 corpses of French people, French citizens in the parks and, you know, in the streets, people who had died the week before in this clash between government forces and the communards, the kind of left wing group in France. And so here's this guy, I mean, we can't even imagine it. You're coming from the worst crisis in the world and deciding to go far away to a country you've never visited to pitch them on this, you know, wild idea. It'd be like after 9/11, one of us going over to China to pitch, you know, making a giant Mr. Peanut or something.
Right.
It's odd. So, and then he's obnoxious at spells. Sometimes I found him very sympathetic, but sometimes he is truly obnoxious. I mean, he talks about, he insults, you know, all sorts of aspects of American culture, you know, from our statuary to our, you know, the large peas that we like to eat to, you know, the way we talk or the way we laugh or, you know. So in those ways, he was obnoxious. But he also was a man with a lot of heart and emotion, and I think that that is the thing that kind of saves the day and, you know, led me to really kind of, you know, appreciate and like him through the writing of the book.
When, in telling the story, what I found really interesting is that this was a struggle, but a 15-year struggle. This was a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many of us in this day and age where everything is so instantaneous would feel, not only the drive to do it, but also the sort of self, the sense of self-worth and, you know, certainty that you had the right idea. I mean, I think that's the amazing thing, too, that it never occurred to them, maybe this is a bad design, you know, maybe I should make it smaller, maybe, you know, it just isn't the right thing to build right now. No, he kept that in his head for all those years, and he got the thing built. And then, clearly, it was a success. I mean, the fact that, you know, even now, 3.8 million people go visit it every year, and its image is ubiquitous. I mean, you see it in advertisements and political materials. You know, it still stirs the hearts of people who have first, you know, have just immigrated here. So, you know, it definitely has, it was a worthwhile endeavor, and he could have easily given it up at any time.
You describe him in the book as being somewhat leery of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when he first came over, he writes back to his mother and he said, you know, I think the biggest problem I'm going to have is that the Americans' main obsession is with money, and they aren't really open to ideas of the imagination. And so he, from the very beginning, he saw himself as different than the American, you know, psyche. He then, as time went on, you know, you expect that the man who made the Statue of Liberty would have been given all sorts of plum commissions, you know, to do other great works. But even after the statue was already basically built, he had to come over and pitch himself, showing little models of his work to try and get a little statue of Lafayette made, and it ultimately was rejected for that commission, and he was very bitter about that. He's like, you know, I cannot believe that after all I've given to America that this is how I would be treated. But he did have some dear friends here. There was a man from New Jersey who was his biggest supporter and really pushed the thing forward, and then he would find, you know, camaraderie with people like the poet Longfellow and, you know, other sorts, politicians down in D.C.
You spoke about this a moment ago of when it came to the myths. So the idea was always that this was a gift from the government of France to the people of the United States. Mm-hmm. You talk in the book about how the money came from a variety of sources, some of it raised by Bartholdi himself. So how did we get to that notion of it being a gift from France, and how would it accurately be described?
I would say that the way we got to that was that when it was announced in France that they were going to begin raising money for the statue, they said this is going to be a symbol of our shared interest in liberty, you know, that both, you know, France was struggling to create a real democracy in its in its country, and then over in the United States we had successfully achieved this, and so France in its suffering was trying to link itself back to, you know, the democracy it had helped fight to achieve. I mean, it was, the French had been our dear friends when we were trying to defeat the British, and so anyhow, it was pitched with some of that language in there, and, you know, about this friendship that would never be broken. I mean, I think there was this idea that maybe, you know, the Americans would even step in to help the French who were fighting for a, you know, constitutional government. So so it was in there, but the thing is, I was just thinking this morning, it's the equivalent of saying that, you know, when you went to Target and bought your mother a gift and gave it to her, that it was a gift from Target to your mother. It's not really true, because the French government didn't ante up the money and it didn't have the original idea. It was the French people, and particularly a small group of people working really hard to raise the money, that made it happen on that side. And then it would, and on the American side, we had to actually raise more money than the French did in order to get the pedestal and have it standing in the harbor. So in that way, too, it's not really a gift. You know, it's more like a collaboration between civilians. I guess that's how I would put it. And it's also a gift from an artist to the world, because if it had not been for Bartholdi having the idea, pushing the idea, sweating over it, you know, arguing over it, it never would have happened.
Originally, he was thinking about putting it in the mouth of the Suez Canal.
That's right. That's what the original design was intended for.
And then that fell through, and then he started to set his sights on the United States.
Exactly. He had actually, he made the model. He had traveled over to Egypt, and he was there when Ferdinand de Lesseps, the man who created the Suez Canal, was first going on his scouting mission, you know, figuring out the particulars of making the Suez Canal. And that was the age where all sorts of people were trying to one-up each other, you know, just impress each other with wild, you know, inventions and engineering feats and all the rest. And so Bartholdi was definitely impressed by the Suez Canal, and so he thought he would try and get his own colossus, you know, similar to the pyramids or the Sphinx there at the mouth of the harbor. But when he traveled to Egypt and presented his little statuette to the Khedive was not interested in it, and then, you know, subsequently rejected it. So then that idea had to sit around until Bartholdi realized, you know, this could be a work that could be about, you know, France and America. And he had some idea that there were intellectuals in France who might be supportive of the idea.
Again, this book is filled with fascinating little facts and things that I just didn't realize. And this gets back to his personality, I guess. So no fool was he. He copyrighted the statue's image. And the idea was, hey, every time a postcard goes out, cha-ching, I get a piece of that.
Isn't that a genius move? I think that just is amazing to me that he could foresee that.
It didn't work.
It didn't work because it was too unwieldy. As soon as the image started cropping up anywhere, every business wanted to use it because it immediately said, it immediately projected America. And if you were in France, it would project this, you know, this great, construction that was going on. So it got picked up by, you know, even laxative companies. And in fact, a laxative company wanted to put its sign on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty for a full year, and they would pay this, you know, enormous money towards the fund. And Bartholdi said, no, thank you. but he did foresee this, and there's many peevish letters from him to his American friend, this Richard Butler, who was the big supporter here, trying to get Richard Butler to go out and fight for his monies from all these different locations, and it was just impossible, and so he had to give that up.
So what should the takeaway be as thousands of people over this summer will flock to the Statue of Liberty to see it in the harbor? What should our takeaway be, do you think, from a story that gives us kind of a warts and all look of how it got there in the first place?
Well, personally, I find it a more moving and kind of beautiful story because, you know, if a government gives something to a government, you know, that just seems almost, I don't know, it seems almost half-hearted. I mean, it is just a symbol. But when you realize that there was this one person who was just determined to make this thing happen, and then he did all sorts of things, like from putting on circus-like productions to raise money for it, and then there were people in America who really went beyond the call to make this thing stand. For example, Joseph Pulitzer, who had bought this newspaper that was basically a dead newspaper, said, "I'll put your name in the paper if you give even a penny to the fund." And then he even sent people out to the factories and the stores to say, you know, come on, ante up the money. And it was the little people of America who got this thing done. So I think that, you know, I was trying to get back to this notion of what we used to be, where people would try to do things just to astound each other, not necessarily to make a killing off of it. And also that, you know, there was this, you know, beautiful thing where the civilians were the ones who made this happen. I mean, sometimes they were tricked into it a little bit, but in any case, it came that way. And so it is, you know, I think it has actually more resonance with the true story.
The name of the book is Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Journalist Elizabeth Mitchell, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you here, and have a wonderful 4th of July.
Thank you. You too. Enjoy the fireworks.
Great pleasure. Thank you.